Good evening, all of you beautiful beings of energy and light. Thank you for joining us under the influence of tonight's full moon as we come together to explore, to connect, to become inspired, and to heal and raise consciousness together. I'm your host, Jessica Dillon Winter, and I pay homage to you for tuning in. I'm coming to you live from the Dive-In in downtown Lake Worth, Florida, and my call-in guest this evening is Stephen Sarge Pickman. Sarge is an extraordinary entertainer with multiple talents. He's a quadruple threat, a musical savant genius who began playing piano by ear at the age of 5. He sings, he's an actor and a comedian, he's even a former sports broadcaster, husband, father, and one very in-tune being with a ton of energy and a lot to say. Sarge, welcome to the show.
I've got nothing to say.
I know that's not true.
after that intro, there's almost nothing I can't do.
I think that's probably about true.
It's amazing. I was actually in a deep meditative state just from the music on hold.
The intro music, I probably need to change that up a bit, huh? Make something a little more lively.
Well, in so much as it's your first night on the air, let's be honest. It was perfect.
That's true. Very true. Thank you for being my first guest. I appreciate it.
Yeah, who did I upset in order to be invited to be the first guest ever?
That's a question for the universe.
The universe. The universe has eyes. Who are you when no one's watching?
That's right. Sarge, tell us your story. You have a very interesting story. I love to hear it. I can never get enough of it. Who
you
are you?
You just told it. I'm a musical savant genius. That's all you have to know. I don't know what else I'd have to do. I mean, unless I could stand next to Dustin Hoffman and beat him at blackjack in a movie.
Now, you're from New York, right?
How clever is that? Come on. Stand next to Dustin Hoffman. Savant. When we think of savant, we think of, you know, I get my underwear at Kmart. I drive slow up and down the driveway. Slow up and down the driveway. I get my underwear at Kmart. Charlie Babbitt's my brother. All right, so I'll crack myself up and the other 9 people that are listening. That's all right.
We're supposed to have more tune in than that, so we'll see.
Is it really a full moon in Lake Worth?
It's a full moon, yes. Absolutely it is.
Wow. So that means all the crazy should come out tonight.
That's right. It pulls out all of the craziness, doesn't it?
So you just want me to do all the work, huh? What's my story? And then you just said, I just love listening to it. And then for 45 minutes, I'm just going to talk.
No, I just want us to start there. I want you to tell people who you are. You have an interesting story. So I want you to
drag it out of me. Knowing your listeners, as you do, I want you to drag it out of me. I want you to lead me to pertinent details. I want you to invite me to share myself with the universe.
Okay. Well, you were very confused growing up, right? For a certain reason.
Boy, there's a leading question, huh? Boy, oh boy, there's a softball. You were very, who wasn't confused growing up? Some of us are still confused now.
I guess that's a good point, but you were adopted, right?
I was adopted at birth.
Right.
From, well, it was a mixed race family. My father was black, my mother was Orthodox Jewish, mm-hmm. and that was my biological family. And, you know, there were two choices, either, you know, an abortion or have the baby and then leave him in a dumpster behind Burger King.
mm-hmm.
And I'm glad they chose neither, actually. My mother chose to give me up for adoption. And my family could not have children. My adoptive family, it was determined that my mother was not going to be able to have kids. So my grandfather arranged with a friend of his who ran an OBGYN division of a hospital in Miami Beach to find a child for my daughter, find us a baby. So he called him on a payphone in New York, which at the time was probably a nickel. And he tasked the head of OBGYN with finding a baby for his daughter. And the doctor said, well, I'll find you a baby, but where are you right now? And he says, I'm in Brooklyn. And he says, great, Brooklyn, New York, I love it. He says, you know this bakery, Ebinger's? It was a bakery called Ebinger's. And my grandfather said, oh, yes, I do. He says, well, why don't you go over there and get me a babka with no nuts? Now, do you know what a babka is, Jeff?
I do not, no.
So I'll have to explain everything, huh?
A babka is
kind of a loaf. It's like a cake loaf. It was brought over from Eastern Europe in the 20s, teens. You know, it's a delicacy. It's like a very, very heavy, cakey kind of Russian delicacy. It's called a babka. There was actually a whole Seinfeld episode on the babka. I don't know if you remember the babka, but there was one babka left, and they were fighting over it. So anyway, to make a long story short, the doctor wanted a babka, so my grandfather bought the babka. He took a taxi out to LaGuardia Airport, hopped a flight to Miami, brought the babka to the doctor in Miami, handed it to him, and said, here's your babka. Where's my grandson? And he took him to a room down the hall, and he says, you're going to have what she's having. And that's how I was. It was an arranged adoption. I was traded for a babka. Nobody knew that I was a mixed-race child. Nobody knew that my birth, you know, they saw my birth mother was white, and they assumed that the father was white. And I was born, and nobody could really tell until, you know, some features started to develop. And ironically, there's a one-drop rule. If you have any black blood, you're black. Just like, you know, and you're not white if you're part black. So I was black, and ironically, I did not know it. I was raised white, even though I looked different than the other kids.
And so you were raised in this Jewish household without much exposure to your black heritage then?
Well, I didn't have any black heritage. My father left before I was born, and there was no heritage. And but wonderfully, though, it's Black History Month.
That's right.
So it would make sense that you would have a black guest on Black History Month on your first show.
That's right, and on the full moon. How is everything so perfect right now?
Well, I had no, I don't know. I mean, I don't know about the heritage. I didn't find out I was black until I was 35. So 39. I went through 39 years of life fielding every kind of insult and joke. So I really didn't find out I was, you know, officially, you know, I knew I was something else, but I didn't know what I was for sure until I found my birth mother. And she told me over the phone about a very brief relationship she had with a guy in college who was a black fellow who was very musical, apparently.
Okay.
And was active in the civil rights movement. And that's all she told me.
And so when you were growing up as a child, you know, and kind of looking differently, as you mentioned, you know, from the other people in your family and your peers, that sort of led to some internal conflict for you, right, as you were growing up?
Well, not knowing what you are,
mm-hmm.
you know, ethnically, racially,
mm-hmm.
You know, I guess the thought occurs to you. But it didn't really plague me. It just was an ever-present part of my confusion about who I actually am. I mean, most people know what they are. They know who they're from. They can look, you know, at their mother, look at their father. They can look at their family tree. They can look at a family album. I think that in the absence of that, you know, it never really occurred to me too much. Because I guess if you're, you know, if you're deaf from birth, I guess you never know what sound is. You know, if you're blind from birth, I guess you never know what colors are. People can describe them to you. So if you're absent of any information about your origin from birth, I guess you don't really miss it if you don't know what's not there.
That's true. Good point. So what
and
led
it wasn't,
you...
And it wasn't there. I'm sorry?
No, what I'm getting at, because I know that you struggled with a past, you know, you've been in recovery for 24 years. So what led you, you know, to abusing drugs and alcohol?
Well, I mean, what I've learned that led me to abusing drugs and alcohol is the fact that genetically I'm predisposed to be an alcoholic or a drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are things that we've learned about alcoholism and drug addiction, is that, you know, those of us who abuse them, it's because we have a predisposition for doing such. You know, we... Mm-hmm. You know, some people use drugs and they use them and then they don't use them, or they stop using them and
mm-hmm.
can stop using them. I have many friends who used all kinds of drugs and they just said, I didn't like the way it made me feel, so I didn't use it. I used drugs, and the fact that I didn't like the way it made me feel didn't matter. I just used them and continued to use them, and used them to an extent that it would almost seem like it was my job to use them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the same experience all real drug addicts and alcoholics have, is that, you know, once they started, they couldn't stop. So it's
mm-hmm.
really, you know, if you're plagued with addiction, you know, the definition of addiction is something that you do that you can't stop doing. Even though you want to stop doing it, you can't stop doing it no matter what.
Right.
And, you know, so whether it began with a glass of Pinot Noir, or, you know, street drugs, PCP, crack. For me, it started with marijuana in college, and I could not get high enough. Other people smoked weed, and they'd pass out, you know, high. Like, they were just so high, they were high enough. I couldn't get high enough. So it's just about my biological predisposition to consume. And it's not just drugs and alcohol. For those of us who are addicts, it's all things. Gum, Oreos, new athletic socks, the way we pump gas, money, sex, breathing. Those people who are addicts have a propensity for being addicted to just about everything.
Mm-hmm. But you were also, though, able to just quit cold turkey, right?
Well, when I quit, it was because there was a confluence of divine circumstances. I mean, you know, I was able to quit because I was supported in doing so. You know, I mean, it got to the point where I had one friend left, and that friend helped me to get help after I burglarized his apartment. I burglarized his apartment, stole all his valuables, and when it came to light that I had done that, he said, let's get you some help. And it was really a divine intervention. It really was the universe interceding and interrupting, which was just a catastrophic downward spiral. And I arrived at a place in Florida, in Delray Beach, where a gentleman who, ironically, is presently my sponsor after all these years, he invited me to pray for the obsession to drink and drugs to be removed from my life. And after a period of homelessness, which lasted about a year, after 10 years of using from what seemed like very harmless bong hits to an escalating consumption pattern, including cocaine, PCP, and massive amounts of alcohol, one night, after all of that, after doing repeatedly and continuously what I couldn't stop doing, after that one prayer, for some reason, I no longer had the desire to do so. And I am just enormously grateful for the intervention of the universe in my pattern, because it illustrated to me in that moment that connecting with the universe is one of the most powerful things in my life. Just because I had tried to stop so many thousands of times, Every night I tried to stop. Every day I didn't want to continue doing what I was doing. It had gotten so awful. And then to pray one time without any experience with any kind of prayer before that, and then to have woken up the next day after that night and not have any desire to drink or drug, you know, it didn't need to be proven to me that there was a power greater than myself in charge of things, which I had consulted.
And I'm sure you were probably very thankful that you weren't standing naked in the middle of a living room on a ladder anymore looking for stash, right?
Wow, apparently you've read my bio.
Actually, I remember I was with you when you were talking to a group of people, and for some reason that stuck out to me.
Were we together?
Yeah.
That's very exciting. When you said when I was with you, it just made me think of other things. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
When I was with you, when we were together.
When we were present in the same room.
When we were sharing an evening.
Mm-hmm.
Clothes.
Yes.
No ladder. Amongst other people who were clothed.
In a train depot.
In a train depot in Boca Raton.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is.
At a secret location. At a secret mm-hmm. location where addicts meet to talk about their feelings.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you were really my first exposure. You know, I myself am not in recovery.
I did not expose myself to you. Wait a second. See, you're getting back to that again.
You
I
didn't.
Did not expose myself to you.
Not
I shared myself with you.
Oh, yes. You were my first exposure to...
Oh, boy.
To this whole world. You know, it's just pretty fascinating. I was pulled into a project starting a recovery magazine just because of my writing and editing skills. And, you know, you were one of the first people I interviewed for the magazine and, you know, heard your story and then subsequently heard the stories of so many other people. And it's just so interesting to hear the circumstances that people have been through in their lives and, you know, how, you know, some people have come to this point where they're, you know, they're ready to tackle trying to overcome it, you know. But and I give a lot of credit to those people because I know it's not easy. So you yourself have dedicated your life to trying to help others, right? Coming through this.
Yeah, but that's, you know, I don't deserve any special dispensation or any exceptional consideration for doing that. I mean, it's literally the remedy for addiction and for living a better life,
mm-hmm.
and that is helping others. You know, it's a ironic but incredible part of the whole deal. It's, you know, you don't get to keep what you have unless you give what you have away, and that's your job. So I don't get any extra credit for doing my job. My job as someone who has been saved from himself by the universe is to make the universe a better place. That's the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the deal. A lot of people do it, and a lot of people don't do it. But I'm here to say that the people that do it have a significantly better go of it. Because those of us who've been saved from ourselves owe it to everyone who's still trying to figure out what to do or how to do it, to show them, to teach them, to share it with them. So, you know, just like a good recipe for chocolate chip cookies,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can keep them to yourself or you can share them with people. And it's much more fun to share them with people because if you keep them to yourself, you just end up eating them all. No, I'm kidding. No, I mean, it's just about paying it forward. It's about there's a selfish component to it. I get to be better when I help other people. I get to hear myself say the things that I need to hear.
Right.
And it's the opposite of self-hatred, which is what engaging in self-destructive addiction is. It's an act of self-hatred, you know, whether it be, you know, voluntary or whether, you know, the gun is to your head, you know, with an addiction. You know, they say that, you know, when you are an addict, you know, you are its bitch. The addiction has you. You don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And so to defeat it, one of the most certain ways of defeating addiction, once you've, you know, come out of it a little bit, is to help others.
Right. And I, you know, have seen so many parallels, you know, with what I've seen in the recovery community and people like you who are out there helping other people. And, you know, you can take so many of the same principles and so many of the things you just said and just, you know, apply them to someone who maybe, you know, doesn't have any substance use history. You know, we all are struggling at some point, you know, through this life, trying to figure things out, trying to figure out who we are and coming to a place of self-acceptance and trying to fit in and going about our lives doing, you know, whatever we do all the time, walking around confused, I think, most of us most of the time.
Well, there are a lot of parallels. There are a lot of parallels, but I mean, for each type of confusion, for each type of addiction, for each type of suffering, I think it's very useful to follow somebody who's suffered the same thing you've suffered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like the principle, you know, like when you hear Vietnam veterans say, "You weren't there, man. You know, you can't possibly understand because you weren't there." You know, I think people listen to each other based on what they've, you know, collectively been through. And when when it's addicts, you know, when I talk to addicts and I speak to young people in treatment who've been through, you know, I know where they're at. I know what they've been through. I've been through what they've been through. I've thought what they've thought. I've been in the kind of despair they've been in. I've been in the kind of confusion they've been in. And it's easier to follow somebody who's been through exactly what you've been through, because you can then mirror how they don't do what you've been doing. And, you know, it has a lot of power to it. The same as breast cancer survivors. You know, if I had breast cancer and I was a woman and I was going to have to go through a double mastectomy, I would want to talk to other women who had been diagnosed, who had been through double mastectomies, so I would know what to expect, know how to feel, know how it changes my femalehood, and know how it changes my body. I would want to talk to another one. I wouldn't want to talk to somebody who'd been through heroin addiction. I would want to talk to another mastectomy survivor. So I think that's what's wonderful and unique about the struggles that we go through, and is that for each kind of suffering, each kind of life challenge, there are other people who've been through it, and the most effective people at helping them through it are people who've been through it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you'll listen to somebody like that, and they can inspire you, and they can move you. And, you know, you watch stories on the news about families that lose children. I can't relate to that because I've never lost a child. I haven't lost any parents yet. I mean, I've lost friends. I've lost, but the very specific, unique circumstance is what gives birth to the connectivity, I think, when people can totally relate to what you've been through and to what you've suffered and what you did to turn it around. And when you're an addict, you know, you determinedly and voluntarily engage in acts of poison and self-hatred, because it isn't the same as getting high. It's getting high because you have no choice, getting high because you're addicted, using substances to replace reality. And so when you reach that place of self-hatred, what you learn from recovery and what you learn from spirituality is that your only solution is to go to the other extreme, which is infinite love, not just love for myself. You know, I many times ask addicts in recovery, you know, what do you suppose is the opposite of self-hatred? And they say self-love, and I say no, infinite love. The diametric opposite of hating oneself is loving everything and everybody. And I know it sounds very la-di-da because we're human, and part of the human condition is to be critical, to be judgmental, to have a difficult time letting go of things. But I have had to learn how to let go of my need to control others, my need for other people to be like me, my need to judge, my need to be critical, my need to resent, my need to hate other people or dislike other people. I've had to learn how to get into a place of infinite love. And one of the things the universe provides is relief from self-hatred. And, you know, addicts have to connect on three levels, not just prayer, not just meditation, but also affirmation, positive affirmation, because what we learn is that our brains are broken. We make horrible choices, and the only way to repair that is to choose, you know, to act my way into right thinking, not think my way into right acting. I have to act my way. I have to take action. I have to put in effort, and I have to practice spirituality. I have to practice meditation, quieting the mind, and shutting it down. I have to practice asking powerful questions of the universe. Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to do? What do you want me to say? And to whom? And this appearance with you on your show, talking to whomever's out there, even if we're just talking to each other, is the answer to that prayer. Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to do? What do you want me to say? And to whom? It's complete compliance with what the universe needs me to do, not what I would want to do. And then affirmation. Affirmation is the positive voice that my mind uses to supersede the negative voice that's in the head of every addict. I can't do this. I won't be able to stay clean forever. I can't change. I hate myself. Why do I feel this way? You know, all that confusion, all that conflict. And the positive affirmation is my application of reversing that voice and making that voice quieter and quieter and quieter until it has no sway over my life. Mm-hmm. And that takes practice. It takes determination. It takes action. So every day, before my day begins, I have to start my day determinedly, like a bodily function. Like I have to install it as an addict. It's you know, three more things I have to install. I have to go to the bathroom. I have to eat. I have to breathe. I never walk out of the house and say, as I start my day, I'm not going to breathe today. I'm not going to go to the toilet no matter what, and I'm not going to eat no matter how starving I am. So given that those are bodily functions that need to be addressed, as an addict, I have to add three more. I have to pray for help every day. I have to quiet my mind every day with meditation, and I have to get ahead of the negative voice. Given that, my brain is my brain. I can't change my brain. I can't just take my brain out and put another brain in. I can get a new kidney. I can get a new liver. I can get a new heart. I can get a finger attached. I can even have my genitalia changed to another gender. But I can't change my brain. So the only way I can change my brain is to work in the spirit of the mind, and the mind is not my brain. My mind is constructed by my universe, by my higher power, by the information I download to it. And in my mind, it's about the things I believe. It's about the things that I tell myself, you know. And so if you change the mind, you can change the life. But if you don't have a willingness to change the mind, the life stays the same. Or the life will be changed for you somehow by circumstances. Mm-hmm. So that's it. That's the totality of what it's about for me.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And there are lots of, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I've been talking a long time.
You have great things to say. I feel a lot of parallels in, you know, in what you say, because, you know, although, like I said, our paths, our pasts are different. We come from different places. We've been through different experiences. I think we've still found ourselves, you know, in the same place ultimately. And, you know, as you know, 2014 was an extremely transformative year for me. Personally, you know, I began the beginning of the year, you know, with the loss of my relationship, my home, my job, you know, and it was the universe dropping me on my ass and saying, you know, okay, Jess, you know, time to wake up and realize what your purpose is here. You know, but every day, you know, it's the path, you know, it's a practice. It's not an arrival. You know, I don't have all the answers. I realize I'm here to help people. That's my purpose, but I'm still a seeker. You know, and I just simply experienced that awakening or that shift in consciousness, you know, that you experienced as well through different circumstance, you know, but it's a constant journey. And that's, you know, I have days, you know, I mean, I'm not happy every moment of every day, you know, and I think probably most people believe that I am, you know, they look at me and think, wow, you know, but, you know, I'm not perfect. You know, it's just the fact that I'm aware, you know, and like you were saying earlier, you know, I feel better when I'm practicing what I preach. And, you know, it's just being at a certain level of understanding, just walking the path, you know. You get derailed, you're aware that you're derailed, and you bring yourself back. And I use some of the same tools that you do, you know, with meditation. I delve very deeply into my Buddhist practice, you know, went away to the monastery for a while and just, you know, bring myself back with those tools that I learned through those teachings and with the meditation. But you have a movie coming up that you just finished making. It's going to have an April Fool's Day premiere, right, called Happy Hour Behind Bars. Is that it?
Yeah, I just returned from Wyoming last week before, where I basically was bringing the message to the guys in a recovery program on the inside of a prison.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a really amazing program where they are given the opportunity and the option to finish their jail term in a recovery program, and they have no idea when they're getting out, if at all. And they have no idea what the length of the term is going to be. They just qualify themselves and determine themselves to get well and to mm-hmm. be in this program. And it's one of the most – I went back in September to this place as part of a gig I was hired to do in Wyoming, and I went to this place, and it was one of the most powerful, inspirational experiences I ever had, which was men that were living their future right now because they weren't entirely clear about what their future was. And it was the truest spiritual expression that, you know, your future is now. It's a collection of nows, and it's now, and it's now, and it's now. And these are men who are changing their lives. They're changing who they are because they've decided that they are willing to change their minds. And irrespective of their level of criminality, it's not open to people who've taken lives. But these men were from the most egregious broken homes, and many of whom had created families with women on the outside. And they've just determined themselves to be better human beings, better citizens, better fathers, better sons, better husbands, and consequently better sponsors of other people in recovery. And it was very inspirational to me. And so when I decided I was going to do a motivational, empowering, humorful film, you know, for people in recovery, because I felt like I was appearing in all these treatment centers doing groups with the patients, and I felt like, well, why should it only be relegated to where I am right now in the universe? Why not film myself doing it so we can share it with thousands of people potentially everywhere? So my reason for doing that, I wanted to shoot me doing it because, you know, I have a fairly unique voice and approach to the doctrines of recovery, because recovery is, you know, from many times books and pamphlets and meditation books, and it's very heavy stuff for people who, you know, it's a vast departure from, you know, getting wasted and getting into trouble. Like, you know, now you're reading books and you're sitting still and you're listening and you're doing what you're told and you're praying when you're told to pray and you're stand over here, stand over there, keep quiet, nobody needs to hear your story, and it's therapy and it's all kinds of stuff. And I felt like it needs to be more fun, because there's a whole generation of young people who are addicted to, you know, pharmaceuticals and biochemically engineered painkillers and muscle relaxers and mind expanders and antidepressants and MDMA and mollies and all kinds of synthetic drugs, and a lot of them are on heroin now. I mean, they're just completely, I mean, I was on cocaine and angel dust, PCP, and once I was off that stuff, I was off that stuff. Once it was out of my system, it was out. But the generation today of young people is addicted to stuff that puts a bear trap on your brain, and it stays in your brain tissue and in your body chemistry, for God only, you know, because these things are pharmacologically engineered to make customers out of all the people who take them.
Right.
And when you take them for reasons other than the reasons that they were intended for, you create just zombies. And I felt like with the young generation, you know, they respect athletes, they respect entertainers and musicians. That's two of the subcategories of professional people that young people marvel at, is, you know, jocks and rockers and musicians and hip-hop artists. So if you're talented and you have a way of entertaining them, I felt like that might be an interesting approach, given that there's so many other approaches which aren't working. So, as a comedian, you know, I went in there and I just explained to them, you know, what is it about the universe? I said, bears know how to be bears. Bears don't wake up in the morning and go, I'm confused. Am I a beaver? Am I a zebra? Am I a whale? No, you're a bear. And bears know they're bears. There's no bear support groups or bear therapy center. There's no bears walking around going, I'm sick of salmon. I'm not eating salmon anymore. I want Pop-Tarts. You know, bears know how to be bears. And the universe has this amazing life cycle to it. Whales make this annual pilgrimage from Alaska to Baja in the warm water, and then they go back up again to spawn and to do whatever. I don't know if they spawn in Mexico or they spawn in Alaska. I know they spawn, but they spawn. You know, birds, the swallows of San Juan Capistrano fly south to South America and then find their way back to this place in California that they like to be. You know, all these things have a cycle to them. Beavers make dams. There's no lazy beavers. You don't see any beavers sitting on the banks of the stream going, you know what, I'm sick of making dams. Every morning they wake up and they do their job as living things in this universe. And the oceans and the planets and all of the things that are around us, which are alive, which are where they are. They're the temperature they're supposed to be, and they're the gravity level that they're supposed to be. Everything just works. And the Native Americans have it right. You know, they know about nature, and they tap into the magic and the splendor and the amazingness of nature. And so I try to share with the young addicts that you're a miracle, in that two cells got together and made a fetus and an embryo and a person, and you're supposed to be here. You're supposed to be here. You're a living thing in this universe, just like everything else. And maybe if you tapped into that perfect order of the universe, maybe if you asked to be a part of it politely, maybe you would have that same Wi-Fi, that inner guidance, that GPS, that all the other living things on Earth know and are guided by. Maybe you'd have some relief from your backwardness, some relief from your confusion, some relief from your lack of guidance.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's more powerful than your addiction. Maybe it's more powerful than your desire to destroy yourself. Maybe it's more powerful than that. If it could, if it can run the planet and the tides and the moons and the galaxies and the other living things and weather, then maybe it could have a very easy time with you. And consequently, you know, I live my life that way, and I'm not confused anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm guided. I'm like a guided missile. You know, and I blow up every day with excitement and with passion and with wisdom and with a desire to make the world a better place for the people around me, in my home, in my life, in my family, my son, my wife, my parents, and then the guys that I get to work with and the patients that I get to be in front of. And then, you know, fortunately, I get to be in front of audiences of people as an entertainer, and I get to do it there. And now I'm doing it here with you. And it's all a blessing. It's all a gift. It's all phenomenal. And it's all part of me saying yes. Yes. You know, will you come on my radio show? Yes. Will you do a show at this place? Yes. Will you fly to Wyoming and work with inmates? Yes. Will you answer the phone when somebody calls and you don't know who it is? Will you be open to being there for whoever it is? Yes. And so everything comes from the yes.
And
and then there's the whole episode of Dr. Phil where, you know, it's people who can't say no. It's like, so you have to learn how to say no. I had to learn how to say yes.
Right. And it's extremely powerful and transformative. There's a lot of power in that. And I think, though, that people are so afraid to do that. That's my belief. I think the fear is what stops them.
Well, I mean, are you willing to let go of your fear? Yes. Are you willing to release your fear? Yes. Are you willing to take some actions that may change your mind? I mean, I think the human condition is so much about, you know, having your mindset. You got to have an open, you got to open your mind and look at your life and look at where you're at and say, do I want things to be different? Do I want to be more powerful? Do I want to be happier? Do I want to contribute? You know, the answer to all of that is yes, 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 and yes.
Mm-hmm.
Would I like to empower others? Would I like to support others in their journey? Would I like to make a difference in the world? Yes. You know, and it's not just about standing someplace and accepting donations for some church or some charity. It's not just about, you know, being brainwashed or conditioned to be a part of some, you know, strange group. It's really just about looking around you and saying, you know, I stand for being a part of what's beautiful and what's good now. Since I was so selfish and so slothful and so gluttonous, the other extreme.
Right. And I think, you know, you talk about selfishness, and I think that's the other thing, too. I think so many of us are just so lost in our heads and so inwardly focused on ourselves, just sort of in this, you know, survival type of mode.
Well, your ticket out of that, and I don't pretend to have all the answers, but your ticket out of inward introspection and overly selfishness is the other extreme, which is selflessness. And focusing on other people and what they need.
Right.
You know, and that's, it's always the opposite. It's always the other extreme. The opposite of the self-hatred is the infinite love. The opposite of the inward overly thinking thing is becoming overly involved in actions and effort.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's mm-hmm. it's like, you know, there are very few bears or horses standing around thinking, you know, I'm confused. They graze. They eat salmon. They protect their young. They hibernate. And then they come in. There's a cycle to life. And I was so out of sync from that cycle. And today I'm in sync with it. I want to live. I want to make my world better. I want to help people. I want to make people laugh. I want to make people understand. I want to reach the unreachable people. not just
mm-hmm.
give up,
mm-hmm.
And not just say, well, he's too backward. I want to be the person that has the voice to reach some of those people where other people don't reach them. Not because I have some egomaniacal determination to be the greatest guy in the world, just because somebody reached me, and I was unreachable for a period. So
mm-hmm.
that's all. And I don't deserve any special medals or awards or honors for, you know, living the opposite of the way I was living.
No, I'm with you. I agree. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, the ego, and that's probably one of the biggest takeaways I got from Buddhism. And that is, you know, just, I mean, we all have ego, but a lot of people don't think about the fact that we have negative ego and positive ego. You know, you have that positive ego that tells you you're better than the next person, and you've got that negative ego that tells you, you know, you're a piece of shit. And, you know, we're constantly struggling with both of those. You know, that's that little voice, you know, the little, you know, devils on our shoulder or whatever, you know, however you want to look at it. But becoming, again, awareness, you know, awareness is so key. You know, you come to that certain state of awareness, you know, and you realize when you have that little voice, you know, that's telling you one thing or the other coming from negative or positive ego, and you try to transcend that. And that's what I try to constantly be aware of, and make sure that I myself am not coming from a place of ego, because I have that concern sometimes, honestly, with me being on the same path as you and just realizing that my purpose here is to help, and just truly, truly coming from a place of wanting to just help everybody I come into contact with. And then, you know, sometimes I wonder, you know, if people are going to think that I'm doing it for some selfish, egotistical motivation, you know, and it doesn't come from that place. So it's
right.
Interesting.
But I don't care what they think. I mean, I don't try to help everybody that comes my way. I try to help everyone that asks me for help, and I try to help every person when I see I could be of some service to somebody. If I see
mm-hmm.
somebody struggling, or if I see somebody that needs help with anything, I usually will insert myself, not just let them struggle or watch them have a hard time. I may say, do I have your permission to be honest with you? Because
mm-hmm.
I really believe that the more that we practice the spiritual stuff, the more intuitive we become, and the more finely tuned our vision becomes in being able to actually see someone else's pain in addition
mm-hmm.
to feeling it. And when you do, and, you know, and so I think it's, some of us are blessed. I don't think all of us have that gift, but I think some of us are blessed with the gift of being able to feel other people's pain. A lot of those of us who are artists, people who
yeah.
are musical or make things with their hands, or you know, visionary type people who can turn thoughts into something, into music, into beauty, into a creation. I think we're even more sensitive than the average person. They say that most people are, you know, who are addicts are thin-skinned. Artists are no skin, and we feel
mm-hmm.
everything.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more in tune you become with that, instead of being in despair about feeling everything, oh my God, I feel everything, oh, I'm so overwrought. Part of it is I feel everything, and maybe I can help do something about that with you.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I can help you feel better. Maybe I can just listen. I mean, not this hour on the radio show, but there hasn't been a lot of listening going on here, but you know what I'm saying.
I do. Tell us about your book, Sarge. You've also got a book coming out.
Yeah, my son is 6, and I am 53. So for those of you who do math, there's a 47-year differential in our age, which means that I lived almost a half a century before he was even born. And the passing of my friend from pancreatic cancer at 47, ironically, the differential between my son and I, made me think about it, because he left behind 2 small children and a wife. And I thought to myself, my goodness, this guy's gone, and he'll never be able to tell his kids about all of that life that he lived before they were born. And it made me think, what if I perish? You know, because we're all given a number when we're born. They just don't
mm-hmm.
call them in order. Yeah. And, you know, what if I disappear, if I go to the next place, and my son never got to know all the wonderful things and all the amazing realizations and all the challenges, obstacles, struggles, solutions, issues that I lived through, that I you know, emerged from, that I have. And so I wanted to share with him all the stories about my life, all the funny things, all the great things, all the ironic things, all the crazy things, and all the solutions that I came up with that were shared with me, that were taught to me, that were given to me, so that he'd be able to know who his dad was in my own words. And so the book is really a gift to him. But it just so happens to be an amazing memoir about, I mean, I've had an incredible life. I mean, right from being born to yesterday, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in so many different careers and so many different parts of my life. So I wanted to share all of those nooks and crannies with him. And in so doing, what I've found is an amazing document that's just, you know, most of the stories in my life story are just the kind when you tell them, people say, oh, my God, that's unbelievable. Did that really happen?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the amazing coincidences and the just everything. The amazing, amazing, amazing.
That will be a beautiful gift to him. I am sure he'll appreciate it very much, and I'm sure many other people will enjoy it thoroughly as well. You know, of course, I know you a little bit more than probably most of our listeners, so I know your story and how brilliant it is. But I would encourage reader or listeners to become readers and to look out for that book when it comes out. What's the title? Did you title it yet? You haven't titled it yet, right? Because you're not finished writing.
I can't title it yet because every time I come up with a title, you know, Stories from the Laughter Life, My Gift to Sander, The Sarge Book. You know, like, it's like I keep coming up with all kinds. It's like until I'm finished writing the manuscript, which I'm very close to being finished, I'll entitle it then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to look at it. I want to look at it as a pile of whatever it is, and then decide what I want to call it then, because I have so many titles in my head, and I haven't come up with anything clever enough. It's like I'm almost overthinking it, so I just want to finish writing it and then pray about it and meditate about it, and then I know whatever it's supposed to be called, I will call it that.
Good plan. Well, we're coming up on the...
Because I have no choice. I'm crazy. We're coming up on the end of the hour, aren't we?
We are. I've almost lost track. I want you to tell us real quickly, though, before we close, and then we're going to do a very short meditative practice, about Sarge's Kids, your foundation.
My foundation is to benefit families and children who suffer from sensory processing disorder, which is something that afflicts all children with autism, but all children who are afflicted with it don't necessarily have autism themselves. So some of the kids are autistic and some of the kids are not. My son is not autistic, but does suffer from sensory processing disorder, and he has almost completely erased because of his therapies and our connection with the STAR Center in Denver, which is sensory therapy and research. So I formed Sarge's Kids to help raise money so that families who don't have the insurance coverage can get the amazing life-changing therapy that they do in Denver, Colorado at the STAR Center. So it's just so that I can do shows and events and raise funds to scholarship families and kids to go to this place that we went when my son was two, because it was the work they did with him there which changed the course of his life. He didn't eat any solid food until he was four, and he was afraid to eat. He was afraid to wear certain clothes, afraid to wake up, afraid to be alive. I mean, really, his whole body just was getting too much information from the universe, too much stimuli from temperature, everything. So it was a systemic reaction to everything. He just gets too much input. So kids with SPD, as it's called, and they can go to sargeskids.com. You can go to iamsarge.com, and there's a click on there for Sarge's Kids. Or you can go to the spdfoundation.net website or the STAR Center in Denver. And any of those will, you know, lead you to that. They do great work. and it's all basically occupational therapy and play therapy. And my son is, like I said, almost completely solved as a result of those methods.
That's awesome. Very good. You are involved in so many great things, Sarge, and doing a lot of good, and I know that you're going to continue on that path and change many lives, and that's awesome. What I'd like to do before we go is every end of every show, I'm going to be reading just a very small passage out of the book by Thich Nhat Hanh, a Buddhist meditation master from Thailand. And I'm just going to let the universe choose what we read each time. So I'm opening the book here, and we are going to land on the practice of metta. To love is, first of all, to accept ourselves as we actually are. The first practice of love is to know oneself. The Pali word metta means loving kindness. When we practice metta meditation, we see the conditions that have caused us to be the way we are. This makes it easy for us to accept ourselves, including our suffering and our happiness. When we practice metta meditation, we touch our deepest aspirations, but the willingness and aspiration to love is not yet love. We have to look deeply with all our being in order to understand the object of our meditation. The practice of love meditation is not auto-suggestion. We have to look deeply at our body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. We can observe how much peace, happiness, and lightness we already have. We can notice whether we are anxious about accidents or misfortunes and how much anger, irritation, fear, anxiety, or worry are still in us. As we become aware of the feelings, our understanding will deepen. Thank you, Sarge, for being with me this evening.
I love you, and I love you all. Thank you.
Good night.